for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In response to the Christmas Day airline bombing attempt, President Obama called for an overhaul of intelligence handling and screening technology. House Democrats held a caucus-wide conference call to strategize about health care reform before lawmakers return to Washington next week. And the nation's unemployment rate in December stayed at 10%, slightly worse than many analysts expected. Joining me for our Friday news roundup, Jerry Seib at the Wall Street Journal, Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times and PoliticsDaily.com, and joining us for the first time, Christopher Rowland of the Boston Globe. Welcome to you, Christopher.
Thank you very much.
And good morning to all of you.
Good morning.
Good to see you. And join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Jerry Seib, I want to ask you first about this jobs report, how bad it looks, what the good parts are.
Well, it's bad in the sense that it's not good. I think there was some hope that the December might be the month where there was a downtick in the unemployment rate and, more importantly, the beginning of job growth to go from losing jobs. And there were not a lot of jobs lost in December, but it's still in negative territory. At some point, the administration in particular is looking for a report, a monthly report that has positive numbers that says we gained jobs rather than lost fewer jobs. And that didn't happen in December. And that's disappointing. It leaves the unemployment rate at 10%, which is probably where it's going to be stuck more or less for a few more months. So it's kind of a treading water report. It's not bad, but it's certainly not the turn toward good news that some had hoped for.
Little good news as far as retail sales.
That's the good news of the week. I mean, the fact is retail sales in the Christmas season were better than most people thought, good enough for most stores to do better than they had told analysts they expected to do, and a sign that maybe the consumer is getting back in the game after a full year of being pretty much scared out of the marketplace for lots of optional purchases.
Jerry Seib at the Wall Street Journal. Now, Lynn Sweet, let's hear about the president's statements yesterday on the terror incident that occurred on Christmas Day. What did you see? What did you hear?
Well, the president basically gave an apology when he said the buck stopped at his, stopped with him. The top national Homeland Security advisor, John Brennan, said kind of in a similar statement, I disappointed my boss when he met with reporters yesterday. So that's kind of the big context of, in a sense, an apology to the people and or taking responsibility, depending how you want to frame it. But what we learned yesterday was just more detail as to what Obama had been telling us since the Christmas incident, Diane, and that is we had an abundance of intelligence information that could have prevented the, and I can't pronounce his name right, so I won't, that could have prevented a terrorist from boarding a Detroit-bound plane in Amsterdam, and that is very chilling. And President Obama said the system isn't wrong. The system just did not work. And in summary, he told everybody to crank it up a lot.
It's interesting, Christopher Rowland of the Boston Globe, that the president said no one individual is responsible. It was the system that was at failure.
Right. And when you read the report, you really see how there were several opportunities where the dots could have been connected. And I think it's really concerning when you consider how much effort, how much money, how much new bureaucracy has been created to stop this very type of attack from happening, or at least to keep those terrorists off planes, that they're unable to make those connections. And this is a day and age where if you're a late payment on your credit card, the credit rating agencies know instantly for all Americans. What is it about these databases that are being collected by the CIA, by the State Department, by all these other agencies? Why can't they all coordinate the same way as so much of American business does? And I think that's what's going to be asked in Congress by the American people in the upcoming months. what can we do to make this system work? We thought we had done this already.
And what about the $1 billion that President Obama has now proposed to beef up this system?
Yeah, some of that money was already in the pipeline, and what it's going to go for mostly is buying better screening, full-body screening machines for more airports, which will make civil libertarians a little worried. But I think most Americans will say, yeah, whatever it takes. So you're going to see more security at airports. One of the things that you'll probably see is a more annoying security, because one of the ways security works is by being visible, by making it clear to people that there is security. So I wouldn't think that this bodes for a more pleasant travel environment in the new year.
One other thing we learned yesterday, when I asked Secretary Napolitano about pat-downs, she said, you will have more. There are only 30 advanced imaging screening devices in the United States right now, 30 or 40. They're expecting 300 to come online in 2010. When you think of all the passengers that go through the United States, that is a big burden on the system to think right now that with that small number of machines, you won't avoid a pat down. So when you talk about, Jerry, civil liberties from a machine, I think people will have to we'll have to deal with it if they're squeamish about having their personal privacy invaded. We are coming into an era. Now, the thing I thought was most interesting, by the way, in the report is the differences between 9/11 2001 and Christmas 2009, where you had in 01 an intelligence system that was not talking to each other. And so we had clues out there that were missed. In a sense, we now have a system that generates so much information. They couldn't assemble it in a way that made, as the report said, and using kind of very interesting language, a story. They couldn't get a coherent story together. One of the things that Wikipedia does is let everybody contribute little bits of information. So if you read it, you might have that aha moment. They were not able to get that story together so that somebody had that red flag or aha moment going on.
Chris.
Well, what I'm wondering really is how much intrusive security measures the American people are really willing to tolerate. I think that, up till now, we're used to now cameras are, in the last 10 years, are at every intersection. They're in every shopping mall. They're basically everywhere. We've gotten used to that. We've gotten used to having to take off our shoes, take out our laptops, all this stuff at the airport. At what point do people sort of say, I don't know if we really want our bodies scanned and so that people can see through our clothes, or do I have to be taken into a room and interrogated just because I visited some, Middle Eastern country?
Well, the answer is going to be yes right now, because if you went to certain countries, you will be. And I think we will have many discussions to come about what this threat means. We went through some of it after 2001, and I know there is a debate about the Patriot Act, and I could see the callers starting up, but when you talk about sacrifices, Jerry just did, and when you know that an explosive was hidden in underwear, in the front of a man's underwear, and you want to figure out a way to detect it, the man went through a magnetometer, and it did not detect it. Hmm. So when I talk about pat-downs, think of what, you're going to be patted down here.
Jerry, to Chris's question, do you believe that the American people, having seen the prospect of this kind of threat on any airline they might board, do you think they will be more willing to give up some of this privacy?
I think probably so. I mean, if you think about the path already traveled, it's fairly amazing. And anybody who 20 years ago traveling, when I was based in the Middle East 25 years ago, traveling around on El Al Airlines, the Israeli national airline, every passenger who gets on that airline is interviewed personally by a security officer. It's just accepted. And, it's a shock to the system when you first go through it. It's the norm when you go through it after that. If you think about the way in which people have given up, carry-on luggage and liquids in the bag in your carry-on luggage and all that sort of thing, I think people have been – it's been graphically illustrated that there's a reason, and I think that's probably what you need to sell it to the public.
And you will have people say, well, we're just staying one step ahead of the last threat. A man hides explosive in shoes, so he do shoes. On the other hand, how can you not respond to having somebody get on a plane with explosives hidden on their body? So it would seem reasonable for people, when you talk about a nation of sacrifice, to readjust your travel plans. And again, this will be much debated. Right now, if you think about flying to Chicago, you think of it as an hour and a half flight, an hour to the airport. I think people will start just rethinking about getting to the airport early. Do you know, after 2001, people really were serious about that 2 hour ahead of time.
Sure.
Deadline
and
of flights.
And they've gotten a little more lax about that. One caller has said she'd rather be sniffed by a dog than have her body scanned. She doesn't know what harmful effects there might be from the body scan, plus doesn't know if records of the scan can be kept. We've been told that they won't be kept. We've been told that they're done and then erased. But, you know, people are very mistrusting these days, Chris.
I think Lynn and Jerry are making excellent points, and I think that people will tolerate this, but they also only if they also have confidence that it's working. You know, I mean, the thing that's disconcerting here is that we thought that we had a system that was working and it wasn't. If there's still not that confidence, if the president and the security agencies can't project a sense that, okay, this is going to work, then people are going to be upset.
I saw some images of body scanning yesterday, and what I saw were things attached outwardly on the body. Would something that's been internalized show up on a body scan? We can talk about that when we come back. Stay with us. And welcome back to our Friday News Roundup, this week with Christopher Rowland of the Boston Globe, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, and Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times. She's also a columnist at politicsdaily.com. Just before the break, I was asking about whether these body scanning equipments would reveal inner cavity hidden items. And the answer from all of our panelists seems to be, we don't know. At some point, I think we all have to do a program on that with experts and get them to tell us exactly how this equipment is going to work. Meanwhile, let's turn to what's happening with the Democrats. Chris, you've got Connecticut Senator Chris Dodd not seeking to run for re-election. You've also got Senator Byron Dorgan stepping down, and you've also got some House and Senate Democrats as well as governors. What's going on?
Well, I think that, I mean, certainly it's disconcerting for the Democrats to have such a wave of people deciding to retire. You know, there's some of this is, I think, normal churn. I mean, there's also defections on the Republican side as well. But I think there's an overriding sense that that the Democrats are somewhat dispirited. I mean, where's the energy that was evident in the Obama 2008 phenomenon? It really seems to have evaporated to a certain extent. And I think that there's, among some Democrats, there's really a concern that they're not, they don't have their traction, their message is a little bit off. The economy is very tough, and they're really heading into a tough cycle in the midterms. Maybe this was it, though. If there are more defections, I think that, or excuse me, more decisions to retire, more resignations, that could be more trouble for the Democrats. But you know, if this is it, maybe they can, and the economy starts to improve, I think maybe they can hold on.
What's happened to Dodd, Jerry?
Well, it was a combination of a bad 3 years or so, really, that it did in Chris Dodd. I mean, he's had a productive year legislatively in many ways. I mean, he's driven a financial regulatory reform bill that's not across the finish line by a long shot, but is taking shape. And he basically finished up for Ted Kennedy on the health care bill. But in the meantime, back home, he's taken a lot of criticism for what seems to have been a kind of a sweetheart mortgage deal that he got from Countrywide Financial before the housing bubble burst. He had a presidential campaign that sort of fell flat, and he is took a lot of criticism, some of this, I think, unfair criticism, for having essentially shepherded through a bill that allowed some bonuses to be paid to executives of companies that were getting bailout funds, something he did, frankly, for the administration as much as anything else. But the combination of all those things produced a kind of a he's worn out his welcome feeling in Connecticut. Oddly, I think his retirement is good news for the Democrats in a raw political sense. They're more likely to hold the seat with the Connecticut Attorney General, Richard Blumenthal, running
to
hold.
He's quite popular.
He's quite popular and seems more popular than the Republicans who are challenging. Nonetheless, in this atmosphere, it was read as another sign of a dispiriting atmosphere for Democrats.
Interesting that Chris Dodd will continue to work on this banking bill, perhaps now with a bit more freedom since he's not up for re-election.
People can't accuse him of catering to special interests or of caving or catering to special interests, depending on how you see it. The Democratic situation also is more serious, at least for the analysis right now, because it comes after the defeat of Democrats in New Jersey and Virginia last year in the governor's races. So for people who thought, well, the Obama campaign in 08, it lifted a lot of ships. Can it translate? There were warning signs, and you could look at the races in Virginia and New Jersey differently. We have, and I know you have in past shows, that there were local reasons. But as you look ahead to 2010, where you have all these elections, the Dorgan and Dodd retirements just signal a worry that there might be some nationalization of a problem going on. And it gives the Republicans talking points and an ability to raise money off of these retirements.
What about Byron Dorgan, and why is he going?
I think that he was looking at the numbers and really saw that he was in for a tough fight. I think everybody is very there's a lot of fear and loathing out there. And I think that some of these candidates are taking the option of stepping out, bowing out with dignity rather than accept a defeat. Certainly that's the case with Dodd. I mean, he was seriously in trouble. I think that the key is that it's pretty clear that Democrats are not going to have 60 to override filibusters after 2010. I think that adds urgency for them to try to get their agenda really moving here, especially obviously with health care, but then the next big thing on the economic Wall Street reforms and the financial services reforms.
Do you agree that it's almost inevitable that Democrats won't have 60 votes?
I think so. You know, it's a strange switch because it's actually Republicans who have more senators who are retiring and leaving their seats open. And 6 months ago, people thought that was a big problem for Republicans. But the climate is so different now. And I wrote in a column this morning that if you look at the lay of the land, it doesn't look as if there's much prospect of keeping 60 votes, and Democrats will probably be left in control of Congress after this year's election in sort of the same way that Hamid Karzai is in control of Afghanistan, which is to say just barely, because they'll get 25 to 30 seats knocked out in the House, which will leave them in charge, you know, by a razor-thin margin. I wouldn't want to run Congress with those kind of margins, not in this environment. And I think it's going to be a very productive time, if that's correct.
Not productive in the sense, what about the health care bill? Do you think it'll pass before?
I do. I've thought for a while that the Democrats are too far out on that limb to let it get sawed off behind them. I think they will do what they have to do in the next month to get that done and then try to change the public perception of the bill, which has obviously slid backwards in a very serious way for them in the last few months, try to make people like the finished product more than they liked watching it being assembled.
I agree. I think that health care will pass. I do think that there's still a lot of really tough decisions to be made as they're now negotiating behind closed doors. One of the key things with the public option, the so-called public option gone, is there's really disagreement between the Senate and the House on how these national exchanges will work, how this marketplace for new insurance will work. There's huge disagreements, obviously, on abortion between the House and the Senate. Depending on how some of these details are ironed out, it's going to make it easier or harder for the Democrats to sell to the American people, because they're going to have to do that once this thing passes. And that there's going to be a backlash, I think, to a certain extent.
Why are the negotiations on the health care bill taking place behind closed doors when it was promised that there was going to be transparency on this?
What President Obama promised many, many, many times on the campaign trail, it was always an applause line, I'm going to have those negotiations on C-SPAN, was a comment he made that even at the time should have been realized he could not keep, because he is not in control of these negotiations, in that there was another partner in there, Congress. The line got wild applause. I can't tell you, Diane, how many campaign places I went to, and he used it. So then why isn't he even trying to keep his promise? I think because in the bigger picture, they would rather have a bill and take some heat right now about not keeping a promise that they think when people write history books or look at his legacy, they'll write he passed a health bill. I don't think there'll be a footnote, but he did it without having C-SPAN cameras there. On the other hand, let's take pledges seriously for a moment. He said it countless times. All the cable channels find it too easy to assemble streams of clips. Robert Gibbs, during briefings, has been asked about it, and his answer, I think, is not addressing the pledge. He says, well, don't you have enough information to write about? I see all your stories. That's not the point. What I think he does not want to do is provide a soundbite saying, acknowledging that this pledge was made and it has not been kept.
So what's more important, a pledge or a bill?
I think from the president's standpoint, definitely the bill. I mean, how often does the legislative branch negotiate in open session really difficult questions of abortion or things that are of really great importance to their various members? I mean, when you look at the Stupak Amendment versus, you know, the language in the Senate that Ben Nelson wants on abortion, you're not going to be able to hash that out in front of C-SPAN cameras.
But I respectfully say that is your point, and I understand that. What Obama, who was a senator at the time, he made the promise, knew or should have known how the system worked. I covered him as a senator, and there was not one time where he worked on any legislation where he even flagged stuff for the reporters covering him, much less inviting in cameras or other people to observe the making of the legislation. So
why did he make the promise, is your point?
Well, I know he made it because it was like, let's throw the lobbyists out of Washington. There are certain things you could say that are very populist. You demonize lobbyists. It works. People reacted to it. The C-SPAN line worked, because it was part of his overall campaign to be an outsider coming to Washington and open up the process. But it was a pledge that even at the time would have been hard to deliver on.
Jerry, how does this work politically?
Well, I think it plays into a bigger problem for the president, which is that he came to office. He campaigned one and came to office as an agent of change. I'm going to change the way Washington works. It does not feel to people, at least if public polling is any indication, that the way Washington works, broadly speaking, not just on this subject but in lots of different ways, is really all that different now than it was a year ago. And that, I think, is the underlying political problem. I think a lot of the Obama appeal, particularly to independents, was not just that he was a smart, charismatic figure, but that he really was a genuine agent of change who had not been in Washington long enough to be part of the process and does not now look like he's the guy who's going to change the process in a very visible way.
Let me also understand Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, who had been very supportive of this health bill for quite a long time. And now, all of a sudden, two things. He's come out against the bill. What were the words he used? He called it a trough of bribes, deals, and loopholes. And then he says California needs more money from Washington.
Well, Arnold Schwarzenegger's got some problems. He's got a budget he can't even come close to making work for the next year. A lot of that money that any state has to shell out goes to Medicaid. What the health bill does is it makes that bill get bigger for states over the next 5-10 years. And President Obama says, you just have to be partners with us. And the states are saying, yeah, partners with you for what? We don't have any money. And Arnold Schwarzenegger has less money than any other governor. So it's a pretty dramatic about face. And it's clearly part of it is political showmanship. He's trying to deflect blame for a problem that he can't solve.
One of the interesting sidelights on this is how Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's nominally supportive of the governor, took him on this one because she said it sounds like the governor is looking for someone else to blame for California's budget, she said, when he was blaming Washington for part of his woes. But he's in his final year. They're term limited. He is in his final year. So he understands that he has legacy issues going on, too. And you know, California is a state that has governed itself sometimes by constitutional amendment, and that this part of what you're seeing is the fruit of that.
Lynn Sweet of the Chicago Sun-Times, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Chris, I know you wanted to add to that.
Well, I think one of the things that I've noticed about the on the Medicaid is it affects states. I think when you saw Arnold Schwarzenegger coming out suddenly against the health care and about California's Medicaid situation, that really is going to be happening in states all across the country. As they apply this law to the states, one thing that will become glaringly clear is that Medicaid, it treats all states differently depending on how much the states spend. So states that have been working hard to spend a lot of money and cover people through their Medicaid programs will get a lot less money than states that have not. So interestingly, there's going to be this sort of tension point between blue states and red states moving forward, where red states have not spent as much money on Medicaid. And I think that what Arnold Schwarzenegger was talking about is just the very beginning of that.
All right. Let's open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Gary, who's in Sterling, Virginia. Good morning to you, sir. Go right ahead.
I'd like to say on this Christmas Day attack that I think we're still dealing with just a symptom of the problem. And what I mean by that is, you know, the question is, why do they hate us so much? Well, if you look at the FiOS Pentagon channel on TV, you'll see where we have comedians who are telling sick, vulgar, and juvenile jokes about the women and cultures of the Middle East. And I think that's an arrogant belligerence that is causing us a lot of problem that has been endemic, especially in the previous administration. Thank you. I'll take my comments off.
All right, Gary, thanks for calling. Jerry?
Well, I would sort of make a related point, which is that I agree with Gary that the attention on the attack is kind of missing some broader points. The broader point that I think is even more important is that what this has shown and what the report actually says and what John Brennan, the president's terror advisor, said explicitly yesterday is that one of the startling things about this attack or attempted attack was that it showed that al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula is more advanced than the U.S. realized. It's a problem in Yemen, obviously. It's a problem in Saudi Arabia. It's a group that works across that border, and it's more organized and closer to being operational, which is to say sending people out to do things, than people realized before Christmas Day. That's the real, in my estimation, the really serious problem that is underlying this discussion. It's not about airport security.
He said that he was asked what was the most shocking or stunning thing that you found out of this review that came out yesterday, and he actually said, Jerry, just to let the listeners know exactly to buttress your point, we didn't know they had progressed to the point of actually launching individuals here, and we have taken that lesson. I mean, just think, that's what they did not know, and they were blindsided.
But it has been known in the intelligence community that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula has been growing and beefing up. And we just had a report 3 weeks before this attack that a number of Al-Qaeda figures from Afghanistan had actually been traveling down to Yemen as the heat has been turned up in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So there were certainly heavy indications that very sophisticated people who could conduct international operations had moved into Yemen.
Christopher Rowland. He's Washington Bureau Chief for the Boston Globe. When we come back, more of your calls, your email. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the Annie E. Casey Foundation, promoting lifelong family connections for children and youth, on the web at aecf.org. By the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide, at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The Friday News Roundup. The Yemeni government launches an offensive against Al-Qaeda. A Pentagon report finds 1 in 5 released detainees suspected of trying to rejoin a militant group. And China opposes additional Iranian sanctions. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. Welcome back to our Friday News Roundup, dealing with, for the most part, domestic issues. However, when you begin talking about things like terrorism, that gets into far, far broader territory. But let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Marie in Jacksonville, Florida. Good morning to you.
Oh, good morning. I just got 2 or 3 things. I'll try to make them short. I just think we could make our country a lot safer and avoid a lot of these terrorist attacks by helping and stop hurting. Petey, and these unmanned drones killing so many innocent civilians, women and kids, we should be addressing the 90% of cocaine that comes out of Afghanistan, the drug problems that people have. They can't grow food. They can't make a living growing the food. And we spent 1/4 of an 1/8 of the money we spend on military contractors, weapon systems, on eliminating poverty, helping these people. I mean, we wouldn't have these problems. And the second, I don't think we would. I think we'd have they'd people police themselves. You know, they would be looking up to us like they used to.
All right, Marie, thanks for your call. This goes back to this issue of why there is such anger out there directed at the United States. She talks about the drones used to apparently kill terrorists, but who are also killing civilians, Jerry.
Well, yeah, I mean, in a way, you have to just accept that it's a war. I think the drones have been fairly effective along the Afghan-Pakistan border in getting to al-Qaeda targets. They have also, and particularly this is true, I think, on the Afghan side, they have contributed to civilian deaths that have contributed to anger in the streets that is a problem for the U.S. So I think the points about Afghanistan, I mean, Afghanistan, like Yemen, has a long way to go to get out of poverty and into development. I do also think, though, it's worth noting that while I think poverty contributes to alienation, which contributes to people willing to do sort of what we see as crazy things, I mean, the fact is the Nigerian was the son of one of the country's most prosperous bankers, and the Jordanian, who just blew himself up in six or seven CIA agents, was a doctor of a wealthy person. So it's not only poverty. It is a cultural clash.
Absolutely.
That would exist with or without poverty to some extent,
I think. All right. To Holland, Michigan. Good morning, Thomas.
Good morning. I wanted to ask you a question with regards to the electorate in general. And I'm kind of curious. Can you hear me?
Sure. Go right ahead.
All right. Just out of curiosity, I've watched this play out in the last year, and I'm kind of understanding it a little bit because of labels. You'll hear labels like Obamacare, and you'll hear labels like socialized medicine, and that plays to people's emotions. But my question is, why does the electorate want to tilt so far to the right that they would actually go past where an established Republican Party sits if the middle or the moderate people are the ones controlling the debate? Because they are overwhelmingly the larger crowd in the electorate.
It's particularly interesting with the rise of this Tea Party movement, Chris.
I think that it's definitely the when the Democrats had the initiative in 2008, they had George Bush to run against. So they were very, very energized. And I think now that what you're seeing is sort of the flip side of that, that now the anger is being directed towards the Democrats and President Obama, the party that's perceived to be in power. And I think that makes it very difficult for the Democrats. And I think that that's one of the reasons that you see, the president ran as an inspirational candidate. And he has become he's governing in a much more pragmatic fashion. The Democrats recognize that this is a sort of still a center-right country, even though he was a center-left candidate in 2008. And I think that that's why you've seen them come closer to the middle and try to pound out these compromises and not take a highly ideological road on healthcare, for example.
Jerry.
Well, I do think it's probably a little bit of an oversimplification to view some of the anger out there as being off on the far right, because I think a lot of it is not really ideological, and a lot of it is populist, and some of it is libertarian, and it's not really conservative in the classic sense, which is one reason I think Republicans can't be sure they can take advantage of it, that they can co-opt it. The Tea Party movement is seething at Democrats, but it's not enamored of Republicans either. So I think you have to look at it as almost a pro-like independent force moving around the country that's not really predictable.
Let's go now to Lowell, Massachusetts. Danielle, go right ahead, please.
Thank you for having me on.
Sure.
I'm someone who for the last 9 years have had CNBC and C-SPAN on each over 23,000 hours. Okay, I consider myself a student of the dumbing down of America and of propaganda and brainwashing, frankly. And, and then what I do is follow what I've seen on a given day, what was important that day. And I'm someone that spent time in Afghanistan. I ran a business in India in the 70s. I have a lot of life experience, and I'm media trained. I just wanted to debunk one you know, I would love to have my own show. Sometimes I want to jump into the television and answer and respond about each thing that's not accurate. So I wanted to just address two things. One, I did see over 2 months' worth of negotiations in committees, both in the Senate, both in the Finance Committee and the Health Committee, regarding the health care bill, where amendment after amendment was added from Republicans as well. And this idea that it wasn't on C-SPAN, I happen to know that Kennedy, before he died, watched these every day. They went on all day. The idea that they weren't on is ridiculous.
And you're at the point.
Prior to that, I'll just finish that, there were many hearings on it. And the other point is about how the drones in Afghanistan, when Obama came in, they definitely switched how they did things. Much more targeted, much more sensitive. Even if they know there's a scoundrel, they don't go after him if there's going to be collateral damage. Yesterday, almost all day, there were airings about the State Department stepping up their efforts with agricultural efforts. Last month, finally, Afghanistan sent 12 tons of apples.
All right, Danielle, thanks for your call. Go ahead, Lynn.
Let me, Danielle, just address the C-SPAN issue. The programming you described is the hearings that would have been on C-SPAN no matter who was president. So that is not what the Obama pledge was about. And by the way, I love C-SPAN, and as everyone says, thank you, C-SPAN. And if your listeners don't know, Brian Lamb this week asked the Obama White House and the most centrally the leaders of Congress to open up these end-stage health negotiations, which is a reason why it's being talked about again. So, Danielle, that is the public hearings that would have been shown anyway. What the Obama pledge was about was taking this to another level and getting the deal-making that happens after these hearings or in between these hearings and making it public.
Do you agree with that, Jerry?
I certainly agree that Obama said that and that that's what he was talking
that
about.
That he would open up the end-stage discussion.
Or some point he would do. See, here's what's interesting about the discussion. Because he really did nothing, we don't have to debate of whether or not he did enough. There was one event in the White House early on where C-SPAN was allowed in. There were three or four panel discussions going on in one day at the very beginning of the process. Nothing after that. So this is more of a situation where we don't have to say, well, there's a hearing, were there two hearings, three, because there were none. It is a harder comeback for the White House.
I think the overarching question here is one of transparency, and he pledged to have the most transparent administration in ever, I think, and basically, there have been some significant efforts on their part to open up the process in the White House so the public can understand what's happening. I think that the visitor logs is a good example. They've allowed the press to see in fairly almost real time who's coming to the White House. That's unprecedented. There's been some efforts to try to declassify materials. They've missed some deadlines on that. But I do think that you have to give them some credit for trying to open up the White House.
All right. Here's an email from Vicky, who says, according to the NBC Today program this morning, body scans do not show anything ingested. They had the head of a company producing these scanners on the show, and this question was asked. So, you know, you reach a point where you say, can you truly know whether you've got a potential terrorist?
Well, look, I mean, it's a technological race between the terrorists and the people trying to stop the terrorists. That's really been true for some years now, and it's going to continue to be the case. It's true on the internet. It's true in airliners. It's true on the ground, and I think that's just the reality. I think people will come to accept that, you know, If it's body cavities, we'll work on that problem next. You know, I think that's probably where we're headed.
That's where we catch up. Let's go to Antrim, New Hampshire. Good morning, Shelley. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you. This has to do with one of President Obama's pledges, where he said that with the health care, he would put a tax on people making, I believe, over $250,000 a year. Yet, and I would like some information on this, my understanding is that someone like me who has no health care, who doesn't want it because I really don't use this Western medical system, would be forced to buy health insurance, which would not cover what I need, and if not, I would be fined. To me, that's a tax, and I don't make over $250,000 a year.
Chris.
What Shelley's referring to is, in fact, in the legislation, it's the individual mandate. It requires that all Americans, with few exceptions, buy insurance. The reason that's in there is that the marketplace would work much better if everybody does buy insurance, and that is the way to try to bring down premiums, and it's also a way to get the insurance companies to abandon some of their abusive practices, such as denying people coverage. It's in the Massachusetts legislation, which is a pioneering state initiative to cover everyone. The individual mandate has worked well. It's actually polls show that it's popular. That people do not object to it. It is indeed a tax, certainly, that if you do not buy it, you do pay a penalty on your income taxes. That's for sure. But the flip side is that the not having people insured costs the system more, and that's the theory.
Jerry.
Well, that's, you know, that's the argument for the whole individual mandate idea, which is there are two problems. One is if you don't have younger, healthier people in the system, everybody's rates go up because you're only insuring the older, less healthy people. And so you got to spread the risk and the pain around a little bit and the burden around a little bit. That's item A. Item B is if somebody who doesn't have insurance falls and breaks their arm, they're going to go to the emergency room. We're all going to pay for that because they're not paying for it with their insurance. That's not fair either. So you can accept or not accept those arguments, but that's the rationale for an individual mandate.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Now to Warren, Michigan. Good morning, Michael. Go right ahead.
Good morning, Diane.
Good morning.
Diane, I was listening to Larry Sabatow the other day predicting the gains, the GOP in the midterms, and your guest this morning, and I am astounded. I cannot believe that the establishment would think that the electorate would actually hand the GOP any gains or give them back the House or Senate after their track record for the last 8 years. I keep hearing this, that because President Obama, you know, is a Democrat, and Democrats or whatever party loses in the midterm, I think the electorate is far too savvy to go for that. Yeah.
What do you think, Jerry?
Well, you look at – first of all, I do think it's too early in the year to draw predictions. A year ago, we were all sitting around talking about the Democratic juggernaut that might produce a majority that would last for decades. And now that was ridiculous. And it's probably ridiculous to draw too many conclusions now about what 2010 will be like as well. But the environment is very bad. History shows you a president's party almost always loses seats, sometimes substantial numbers of seats in the first midterm after he's elected. And that's in a good environment. And this is not a good environment. I think there is a sense in the country that there's been some Democratic overreach, and they're going to pull the party back. So what does that translate into precisely? I don't know. My guess would be it translates into smaller Democratic margins of control after the election, but probably not a loss of control of Congress. But that's my guess in January of 2010, not November of 2010.
Leah.
The elections are a long time off, and the Obama White House, if they show change, if they have that people relate to, if the jobless rate goes down, if your housing prices stabilize or go up, you might have just a very different environment. There's so much time to go on. One of the things that some of the Obama team emphasizes is that no one said this was all going to be done in a year when we talked about change and hope. And even some of their promises, going back to transparency, they never said, with the exception of the C-SPAN thing, and by the way, I do agree they have done a lot on other matters, but you can't ignore the one very simple pledge he made. So the idea sometimes that people have is we get to the one-year mark that there is a notion somehow that he promised this, so why isn't it done yet? While this is really just a work in progress, and as we get closer to a November election, you will see more for better or worse. I mean, this handicapping that will go on will change. And one thing that no one ever expected, even in talking about Obama's year end, was an attack. Another terrorist attack. So I think these things are very subject
I think that ultimately what's going to spell success or failure in the 2010 midterms will be the economy. And I think that the question of jobs and this the unemployment numbers are going to really be the key. And I think that that's why today's 10% unemployment figure was definitely a discouraging spot for the Democrats.
This afternoon, President Obama is expected to speak on this, outlining exactly what he has in mind for job creation, job growth. I'm sure we're going to be focusing a lot on that next week. Christopher Rowland of the Boston Globe, Jerry Seib at the Wall Street Journal, Lynn Sweet from the Chicago Sun-Times, and PoliticsDaily.com. Thank you all.
Thank you very
Thank
much.
You.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, all. Have a great weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.